He explained to me how, you know, it's traditionally done in corporate America. And so I just played stupid. And I said, oh my gosh, you mean because you make like 5 times the salary of our receptionist, that your share of the profit should be 5 times the receptionist? And he said, yes, exactly, you've got it. And I said, and you're fired.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. This is the show where we talk to disruptors who are founders, executives, about what they uniquely see different about identifying top talent. If you're a first-time listener, we appreciate you joining us. For our long-time listeners, always appreciate the support. Please subscribe on Spotify and Apple Music or wherever you listen to podcasts and give us a great rating. Today, we are joined by a very special guest. I am very excited to introduce you all to Sherry Deutschman. She is the founder and CEO at Brain Trust. Sherry, how you doing?
I'm doing great. It's awesome to be with you today.
It is great to be with you too. People are hearing that Southern accent right off the bat. I want to let them know you're in Nashville, Tennessee, one of my favorite cities in the world.
Yeah, Nashville, Tennessee, home of country music. Well, actually, just home of music.
Home of music. Yeah. There's all different types of music out there. And my youngest daughter, my middle daughter, is trying to get me to fly out there. There's a concert for a country singer she wants me to take her. So I'm probably going to be out there pretty soon visiting there and seeing some of our employees out there. So hopefully we can get some time in person. But I want to jump into it because you are an entrepreneur. You've built some amazing things. I've really enjoyed our pre-conversation. I want to dive right in. The founder and CEO of Brain Trust. I always want to start with people understanding a little bit about the company and its mission and vision. So can you start with us there?
Yeah. So I'm a member of EO, the Entrepreneurs Organization. And I'm guessing that a lot of your audience members are members of EO, YPO, Vistage, organizations like that. And being a member of EO was really pivotal to the growth of my first company and a fantastic exit. And I had all these young women coming to me wanting me to mentor them. And I'm a terrible mentor. I'm a problem solver. And I just wanted to jump in and solve the problems. And I said, no, you need to help each other. And I said, join EO. And found out they couldn't because they didn't meet the revenue requirements. So like only 2% of women ever get to $1 million in revenue. And only 7% of men do, by the way. And so there's this huge 14 million women in the U.S. that are business owners that need that peer membership advisory and that don't qualify, had no place to go. And so I created Brain Trust for them to help them just hold each other accountable and be a resource for one another to help them grow and scale their businesses. And we've had enormous success already.
I love that. It's such a need out there. I'll say this. I'm a YPO member myself. I've attended a lot of business meetings. That community, that like-mindedness, that being able to share freely and be around people that are doing amazing and great things, who have gone through struggles, who have gone through challenges that you can learn from and then be able to share that with others. It's just such an important part of your own self-development and growth, your own sanity in a lot of ways. And to your point, there sometimes can be gatekeeping in terms of different like levels of criteria you have to fulfill to be involved. And so I think you're doing a really big time service. And those numbers you said are shocking. So only 2% of women entrepreneurs,
right,
or women in the world?
Women founders.
Women so, founders get to 1 million in revenue,
right,
and 7% of men is what you said.
Right.
Wow, that is
exactly
an incredible
thing. But there's a close correlation with, I think, the investment world too. So interestingly, women only get 1.7% of venture capital. And women of color, oh, they get like a fraction of that. So there's this huge need, a huge chasm. And I say that in spite of the fact the data shows that women produce a higher ROI than do men. Significantly greater. Like I think the Kauffman Foundation said that we're 38% better. I forget. Boston Consulting Group said women produce 68% higher ROI than male-founded companies do, and yet we are still kind of locked out of venture capital world.
Well, listen, I know tons of brilliant women founders. I've been lucky enough to have a few on this podcast. I definitely have them in the organizations I'm in and in part of my network. I'll tell you what, I know that a ratio of male founders to female founders is not 1.7%. So the fact that the venture capital money is only flowing to a certain way, and then only flowing to a certain way of the people of color, that's something that needs to be improved. That's a big opportunity out there. And it's just great to talk to people and be around people who see that mission and want to make that mission something they want to improve. We talked a little bit about the companies on fire right now.
Yeah.
So I'm just interested why you think you're having this level of success and how fast are things moving? Because when things are on fire in a startup, it can mean one of two things. It can mean not good, or it can mean like, oh my God, we're hockey stick growth. But one thing I do know is that things are moving really fast in those moments. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, the company and where it's at right now?
Yeah. So what we thought would happen is that women would get to $1 million in revenue and then they would move over to EO or to WPO, the Women's President's Organization. And they didn't. The ones that made it to $1 million said, no, this is how I got there and I'm not leaving. So now just in Nashville, Tennessee, we have 50 women that have gone from, gone right from startup to over $1 million with one who's at $1.4 billion who joined us pre-revenue. And that's just in 5 years.
Wow.
And then on average, our membership last year in Nashville, and altogether there's 220 members now in Nashville, on average, they grew revenue by 227% last year, year over year. What business doesn't want stats like that?
It's amazing.
And it's really, it's because of the women helping each other. So it is part of how we've crafted this thing was, you know, why did I want EO to be for me when it comes to accountability and what did I wish that I had there? And so it starts with women coming together in these small groups of just seven, being very vulnerable. In fact, the first thing they have to do at every meeting is report to the other six women around the table exactly to the penny what their revenue was the previous month. So there's no BSing. You cannot pretend you're doing well if you're not. And it's more likely with women that we don't want to brag about how well we're doing. So we don't want to share those good numbers, but the rest of us need to know what's possible. So you start by sharing that, and then you bring your problems to the table, just like you do in YPO, and you help each other vet those opportunities. What's extraordinary about this is the women being willing to share resources with each other. So for many of them, it's I've got an investor who I think is also would be keenly interested in your business and making those introductions, doing businesses with one another. And then something really extraordinary happened a few months ago where one of our members reached out to me and said, hey, I need to borrow $40,000. I need it right now. I don't have time for the banks. So I said, let me post it on our portal without attribution and see what happens. And another member jumped in immediately to loan her the money. She had the money the next morning. The money has already been paid back. And so it's just the women believing in each other and being willing to step up and support each other and to hold each other accountable. There was another situation where I know a woman was saying she needed to bring in some investors, and her group said, no, you don't. You need to watch your spending. We see all these things that you're spending money on that have nothing to do with your business. And if you just curbed your spending, you would be totally fine without an investor. So I love that level of accountability and honesty and vulnerability that's really what is propelling us. So, you know, the women are building extraordinary businesses in every industry, from manufacturing to tech to, professional services. And, some are building companies that we have a few who will be billionaires, several who have serious unicorn potential. But if we've got a woman who's got a hair salon and we can help her get from $250,000 a year to $1 million a year, that is game changing for her family and for her employees. So we want those Main Street businesses as much as we want the unicorns.
Incredible. And I was going to ask you, because, you know, I want people to really understand your business, because if they're interested and want to be involved, you know, tactically, story-wise, tell us like some of the success stories. And you just illuminated those.
Yeah.
Women helping drive each other, holding each other accountable, no pretenses. I love it. I love everything you're doing. I want to ask you, and we're going to talk about LetterLogic in a minute, because that was a company that you founded that you had great success with. But I want to start a little bit on the entrepreneurial journey. Mm. I always find that to be super interesting. You know, some people were, you know, having lemonade stands at 8 years old. Some, you know, ran into a wall in corporate and just didn't have a choice and went entrepreneurial. Some had a lot of options and said, I still want to go down this route. I'm interested. How did you find yourself, right, stepping into this world that chewing glass and staring off into the abyss and the ups and downs that come with it? How did you become an entrepreneur?
I've never heard that expression, chewing glass, but man, I have lived that. I didn't know what the word entrepreneur was until after I was one. So I grew up in the mountains of North Carolina, and my family are all Jehovah's Witnesses. And Jehovah's Witnesses don't really encourage, you know, secular education. So I had only a high school diploma, got married at 18, because that's what JWs do. And by, you know, 23, found myself divorced and moving to Nashville to pursue a career in music. But before that, the only work I had done was scrubbing toilets. I had a route where I cleaned gas station bathrooms. Yes, pretty bad job.
I've been in gas station bathrooms. That's probably on the lowest list of bathrooms that you want to be cleaning. So.
It is. And I was a maid. I kept house for a couple of the wealthy families on Beach Mountain in North Carolina. And I was a receptionist for my dad's plumbing company. I had to do all of those things to support myself and my daughter. And we moved to Nashville to pursue a career in music. And for the first couple of years I lived in Nashville, I often did not have electricity because I couldn't afford the daycare bill and the light bill, and had to choose. And it had to be daycare because I had to go to work. And so I went from that to working for a company in the healthcare revenue cycle space and sales. And I did well. So I started making six figures and more, and became vice president of sales. And the company that I was working for just didn't appreciate me. And we had so many problems in customer service that I felt like I was a professional apologist. All I did was apologize to customers and grovel to try to keep them. And all of our problems were just simple human error, just careless mistakes. And so I went to my boss and said, hey, you know what? I think if we worked on the morale of the employees more, they would quit making these silly mistakes and we wouldn't have to keep, you know, this churn of customers. And he reached across the table and patted my hand and said, Sherry, you don't know anything about business. Why don't you just go sell something? And so I was hurt, angry, and I left there that day and never stepped foot in his door again. And I went and started a company competing with him. So I cashed in my 401k, sold everything I had, had a week-long yard sale, and I didn't have a lot anyway, but I sold it all. And went down to Goodwill and bought myself those two, you know, little short filing cabinets. Bought two of those and then got an old door, pulled that over the filing cabinets, and that became my desk. And I had a landline and a leftover laptop from my previous employer that they'd given me. And I just started dialing for dollars. And I decided that I knew that industry pretty well. And I figured that if I just focused on the employee morale, that I could build a much stronger company. And so I just set out to build a company that put the employees first, not the customer, which is kind of weird, but that's all it took. So I got to about $1.5 million in revenue in the first 18 months and ran out of money. Didn't know that you could grow so fast you outran your working capital, because I didn't know. I mean, I really didn't know anything. When my boss said I didn't know anything about business, I mean, he wasn't wrong. I didn't know how to read a P&L. I didn't know what a balance sheet was, but I knew human nature and I knew how to sell. So I went to the bank and asked for money. I needed $350,000, I thought, and they said no, but they took me to a man in Nashville who had taken 42 companies public, and He invested $350,000. And it's like one of the highlights of my life. I might get emotional about this. To be able to meet with him 10 years later and give him a check for $14 million for his investment. It was a home run. And Oz, the whole thing, our whole secret, our success was putting the employees first. And so it was my job to go meet with our prospective clients, and they were big healthcare systems. All the biggest healthcare systems you can think of across the country, those were our prospective clients. And I would sit with them and say, I want you to sign this contract today, but you have to know that I don't believe the customer comes first. But my employees come first, and I'm going to take such good care of them that when they are at work, they are solely focused on you. And you are going to get the best service you've ever had from a vendor, and you're going to be willing to pay a premium. And they did. So we grew enough to be on the Inc. 5000 list for 10 straight years. Had no debt, just kept growing like crazy. And we were, self-funded. And we even had, our sales team said that 85% of their sales they were closing were culture sales, saying, we chose you because of the culture. We know that's going to benefit us. And it did. So I think it's really critical for me to share this one important part of our culture was, the benefits program was a real fair living wage. We paid 100% of everybody's medical, dental, disability, and life insurance. Everybody got to bring their kids to work anytime they needed to or wanted to. We helped them buy their first homes. So we helped 22 employees buy their first homes with a gift for the down payment under closing or closing costs. And then a profit share plan that was the single best idea I ever had in my life that was absolutely game changer. And that
I want to double click on that real quick. So just I want a couple of things I got to say. So number one, like incredible story. Like when they talk about the entrepreneurial journey, like that's a movie right there. That's impressive. That's amazing. From going to cleaning toilets in bath and gas stations to being able to write and hand over a $14 million check to an investor when you needed that person most. I mean, that is the true American dream right there. I'm so, so impressed with that. I have some things I want to ask you about the employee mentality, because I think, I very much believe in exactly what you said. The one thing that I try to balance is, the idea of being employee first, but also maintaining an organization where performance matters, right? And driving performance matters, right? And I don't feel like those things have to be mutually exclusive, but sometimes it can be a hard needle to thread. And so I'm just interested, how did you manage to make both of those things integrate and work well? And maybe it's the profit sharing plan, and you can talk about that.
That is the common thread right there. So most profit share plans are based on a percentage of your salary, and they're done. Any distribution is done once a year or once a quarter. It's very nebulous. You never know exactly what you're getting or what what really created that pool of profit. And it's such a minor thing that there's no way for you to attach it to your personal performance. And, with my high school education, I never could understand really how that profit sharing plan worked. And so I thought, I have to devise something that everybody here, people who have the same level of education as I do or less, can understand how this works and for it to be a compelling driver for them. And so my profit sharing plan was this. Every month, I brought together all the employees in a room, and the room kept getting bigger and bigger. We had lunch catered in, and we went over the P&L. And so they saw to the penny how much money we took in and how much money we made. And then we took 10% of the bottom line or whatever it was, and we evenly distributed it, meaning that our janitor got the same thing our CFO got. And that's not how most profit share plans are. You get as a percentage of your salary. So the higher up the chain you are there, the greater you get. Your salary is already you know, so different because that's based on your education and your experience. We didn't need another delineation. And we had people saying, well, you know, your CFO should get more, shouldn't they? Yeah, wait till the toilet's overflowing and tell me who's more important in your organization, the CFO or the janitor. And so I said, everybody here is equally important. We can't do without anybody. And so that's why you're all getting an equal share. And so our first profit share check was $7. You can't even buy a six pack with $7, you know, but everybody was really excited about it because, you know, it was something that they felt like they had earned. And so in those monthly meetings, when we went over the P&L, we talked about the results and why they were the way they were. So if we'd had just a kick-ass month and we're making so much money, everybody knew exactly why. We'd done exactly what we were supposed to do when we were supposed to do it. And then when we had months that weren't so profitable, we could talk about that and without pointing fingers, because really we all had a share in the results, we could talk about what went wrong and how to correct it. But what it did was make people, by sharing the P&L, it made them more vested in the bottom line and made them draw a direct line between their personal performance and the bottom line. And they cared. They understood how they affected the bottom line. And so it had them bringing ideas to us for ways to cut costs, a way to get more efficient. You know, a specific example was we had a deadline by 6 p.m. At 6 p.m. or 7 p.m., the U.S. Postal Service was pulling away the two tractor trailers worth of mail every day. And it wasn't 7:01 or 7:05, so it was very time bound. Everything had to be on that truck, the door closed and ready for them to pull it out. And we were getting to where we were doing over 400,000 pieces a day, so it was a lot of mail. And our head of production out there said, we're really running into a time crunch, and I'm afraid that we can't make it every day, so I need a few more hires. So I approved it and said, what shift are they going to work, and who's going to train them? And he went away knowing he could hire two new people. And as he was walking out the door, I said, by the way, have you looked at how this is going to affect the profit share? And you could see the light bulb go on in his head. Two more people to share in the profit. So he said, let me work on this. Came back the next morning and said, hey, we all got together. We only need one person. Because it made them realize that they could be a little more efficient, do these things to keep that share down to just one less person, which made their part of the pie bigger. But it also made them be very careful about who they recommended to work there. It made them jump in to train new people quicker and to teach them the little tricks that they had learned of how to be more efficient, because it all affected the bottom line and affected the paycheck they were going to take home. Not the paycheck, but that extra bonus. And so the profit share checks grew from $7 to $70 to $700 to over $1,000. And if you're making $25 an hour and every month somebody's handing you a check for $1,000 for the profit share, it builds incredible loyalty and it makes you just think about the company in a different way. So it really created a whole company of owners. We should have been an ESOP, but I wasn't sophisticated enough to know what an ESOP was. And by the time I knew that, it was the company's value was really out of the grasp of the employees. But the profit share really served the same way.
So I got a couple of follow-ups there. So nothing changed on the cap table. It was just strictly, this is the profits that comes in. This is how we distribute it. Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
What about when you didn't have somebody or multiple people pulling their weight? Would that mean that you would be quicker to say this isn't a fit? Would that mean that people would be quicker to call that out because they knew it was impacting their profit share? Like, how did that work?
The latter. They would jump in to help you get up to speed as quick as possible. But if they saw pretty soon that you weren't going to be a full contributor, you were voted off the island. You know, they would say, hey, we're all killing it here. And no matter what we do, he's not pulling his weight. He's got to go. And And he did, you know, learning to, so we started trying to hire for, you know, culture fit early on. And we got a whole lot tighter with that, having group interviews and, you know, trying to hire just people who got it. And so it enabled us to, you know, build a $40 million a year company with only 52 employees.
What about, last question here, because I'm just interested in the dynamics. This is brilliant. And it obviously worked well beyond what you could have even imagined going in. What about when you would hire people and other people weren't like necessarily in that group or anything, and but they had to share and cut that up? Did that lead to any conversations, resentment or anything like that?
So I hired a CFO, a young man who was, you know, brilliant. And he came in, you know, blowing smoke saying, man, I love this culture. I love the profit share. I love the way it works. This is amazing. And a couple of months into it, he pulled me aside and he said, I love your generosity and your naivete, but I don't think you understand exactly how a profit share plan is supposed to work. And so I said, well, explain it to me. And he explained to me how, you know, it's traditionally done in corporate America. And so I just played stupid. And I said, oh my gosh, you mean because you make like five times the salary of our receptionist that your share of the profit should be five times the receptionist? And he said, yes, exactly. You've got it. And I said, and you're fired. Because you will never be more important than our receptionist. And you feigned that you bought into what we were doing and you know, thought he was above it all. So yeah, there were definitely times when some people came along and we tried to weed that out in the interview process, when some people thought they were more special, and we got rid of them. So we ended up with a really tight team. It's funny, I sold that company in 2016, and I think not a day goes by that I don't have interactions with at least one of the employees. I went to dinner with two of them Monday that I hadn't seen in a year. And, you know, I know it sounds trite to say we were family. We were. They were with genuine love and affection for one another.
Oh, sure. I love that. What an amazing story. I think there's a lot to be learned from that. You got my head spinning on a few different items. I am so appreciative of you sharing.
Finding the right talent for your team doesn't have to be a struggle. Meet Aon Hire, the world's first hiring experience management platform designed to transform the way you hire. Powered by AI, Aon Hire takes the hassle out of every step in the process. From smart resume analysis to customized interview questions, it saves you time, money, and effort. Plus, with real-time insights from every interview, you can quickly identify top candidates, reduce turnover, and stay on budget. And forget about note-taking. Aon Hire takes care of that for you. Ready to revolutionize your hiring process? Visit aonhire.com and get started today.
You talked a lot about the hiring and the people coming in. I want to get to that in a minute, but I want to ask you about this. I work out of the Entrepreneurial Center. Our team does. And when we're in Nashville, you're on the board at the Nashville EC. And there's something called the Next Awards that celebrates the founders and startups in Nashville. I think it happened in October of last year. Always happens, right? Yes. Can you tell us about the event and why this is something you want to be involved in?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, entrepreneurship, look at what it did for me. It's not just about building wealth. For me, it was about building influence and giving me a seat at that table on the board. And my board term is over now, so they plugged in my husband instead of me, who's also an entrepreneur. But the influence that comes through entrepreneurship is just so important to changing the world and to creating a world that we want to live in. You know, when I had my other company, I was featured in the New York Times for our culture. And that got me to the attention of Tom Perez, who is U.S. Secretary of Labor, who spent a day with me. It got me to address Congress on the minimum wage and why the minimum wage should be increased. It brought me to the attention of the president, who named me a White House Champion of Change. So that was President Obama who named me a White House Champion of Change. And that facet of entrepreneurship, the power that it gives you, the megaphone that it gives you, is huge. It's way more important than the wealth. And I want to afford more people that opportunity. And I believe that the Entrepreneur Center in Nashville is really second to none in the way and how critical it is in our community of being really the hub of entrepreneurship and connecting entrepreneurs to the resources that they need. And so it's been really important to me, and I love being able to give back by supporting the Entrepreneur Center any way that I can. So my husband and I hosted the Next Awards for 3 years and helping them raise money for that, and shining the light on incredible entrepreneurs who are building wonderful companies.
I love it. I've seen the pictures from the event. I hope 1 year to get invited. I'll wear my tux and my cowboy boots and cowboy hat and come out there and get on national time. But yeah, it's an incredible thing that you do. And I agree. It's such a, the EC in itself is an amazing thing. What they're growing in that community out in Nashville. And you brought up something a little bit earlier that I found in spades out there. It's very tight knit. People want to invest in Nashville based companies. People help each other. And there's a lot of like camaraderie in that you don't see in every other entrepreneurial community that I see in Nashville. And so it's something that I felt the minute we started working there. It's something I see day to day when I work with clients and customers out there and the people that we've hired out there. I'm grateful to be part of that community. And it's one that, you know, I keep seeing future trends of just continued growth and amazingness. And a lot of it has to do with organizations like the EC and people like yourself. So I appreciate you sharing that.
I have to give credit to the music industry for our collaborative spirit in Nashville. You know, most of the songs coming out of Nashville weren't written by a person. They were written by two or three people who are all writing for different publishing companies who get together because they know that their ability to have a hit song is much better if they co-write and bring, you know, different talents and sensibilities to the song and different viewpoints to the song. And I think that is really what created this atmosphere of collaboration in Nashville, of even competitors are willing to help each other, do referrals, connections to investors. It is a really unique community in that way.
I hope the Nashville Chamber of Commerce picks this up and they use this as an advertisement, because it's a great community, one where entrepreneurs consider opening a business. I want to talk a little bit about hiring, because that's my obsession, and it sounds like something that you successfully did throughout your career and continue to do so. I want to start by asking you this question. If you had to have a core hiring philosophy in terms of the people that you want to bring into your company, what would that look like?
I think the two most critical things are integrity and humility. And I think those are closely related, but the ability to learn, the idea that you can learn something from everybody else in the company, regardless of title, and the ability to fess up to your mistakes, not to cover them up. You know, back at Letter Logic, we had a mistake quota where you had to go to your monthly meeting with your group and talk about the biggest mistake you'd made and what you learned from it. And that made everybody feel comfortable about talking about the mistakes. And my mistakes were bigger than everybody else's because they had more dollar signs attached to them. And so it started with me. So finding people that were able to talk about their mistakes and failures and being honest and humble is critical. And then I'll have to say that I've only hit it out of the park 50% of the time.
Mm.
And you know,
I wanted to ask you about that. So let's dig in there, because yeah, I think not a lot of people, that's by the way, that's your humility. That's you leading by, because every time, you know, hiring, the thing about it is, especially when I talk to founders, everybody thinks they're great at it. But the yeah, reality and the data does not back that up. So you said 50% of the time, it doesn't work out. When you missed, can you look back at a theme that maybe, God, I wish I would have done this differently, or maybe a bias you had up until you figured it out? Like, is there any type of theme that you'd say when you miss on why it happens? Or do you think that's just the nature of humans and the interview process and trying to make decisions off of a few sessions?
Yeah, it's, I realized that when they were coming in, instead of them trying to sell me on why they should be hired, I was trying to sell them on what a great company we had, and that I needed to shut up and ask questions that had, you know, that drew them out more. And, you know, questions like, and this was really uncomfortable for some people, but, you know, when was the last time you witnessed any kind of injustice, and what did you do about it? and then just sitting in the silence and the discomfort until they could think of sometimes. And if they hadn't witnessed any kind of injustice in our society, in our world today, that meant they were totally not observant.
Mm.
And
I love that. You must have gotten some really, and I was going to ask you, what's one of your favorite questions to ask? That's one of the better ones I've heard. And I got to be honest with you. I look at this when I look at like the people I want to surround myself with, my friends. That's something that I actually think about. Like, if you saw something at a bus stop and you knew it was wrong, are you the type of person to put your head down and walk by? Or are you the type of person? I feel very strongly that I'm that type of person that, you know, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. In fact, sometimes to my own detriment. But it's hard for me to see something like that and not want to say something or do something and stand up for somebody who might not be able to do that. I'm interested. What's an answer you might have gotten that like really like floored you, or that was like, I got to hire this person immediately?
Well, one woman said she told me what she'd witnessed and that she hadn't done anything about it and that it had plagued her. And she talked about being in a nail salon waiting for, and the nail salon was open and she was trying to, you know, getting a pedicure, and the two gay men walked in for service, and the owner told them, no, we're closed. We don't have room for you. And they could see that there was capacity, and she didn't do anything about it. And it plagued her that she didn't speak up. And they left, and a few minutes later, some other people came in, and he immediately seated them and serviced them. So that, I love that it bothered her, and that she was able to think of a few minutes and say, oh, this killed me. It still kills me that I didn't step up and do something. And then, you know, another practice that I had was knowing that I needed people with some pep. We were time bound every day. And so I would stand at the window. If I was expecting you for a 3 o'clock appointment, I would stand at the window 2:45. I wanted to see your approach to the parking lot. And were you coming in ready and confident, or were you coming in last minute, in our gravel lot, stirring up dust and, you know, adjusting your time, running up the stairs. And that applied to everybody except IT. Because the skill set is so different that I was looking for something different there. But, you know, there are times when I disqualified people before they ever got to the front door.
Wow. You got some great insights. I'm interested. You got to have a good, memorable interview experience, whether good, bad. You know, you don't have to name names, obviously, but I'd be interested to hear any kind of, when I ask you about a memorable interview experience, what first comes to your mind?
This is not really about that person, but a young man I was interviewing who got his interview because he said he was best friends with one of my favorite workers on the production floor. And his friend happened to walk through our lobby, which was like a fishbowl thing, and see him and like a little puzzlement and waved. And later after the interview, he said, what were you doing with him? And I said, interviewing him for, you know, the open job. And he said, do not hire him. And I said, he says he's your best friend. And he said, he is. And he's a partier. He's never going to be on time for work on Mondays. He's going to leave work early on Fridays. He is not reliable. We do not want him here. And it was that the whole profit share plan and that culture of ownership, which made him know, yeah, I want to party with him on the weekend, but I do not want him part of this family here.
Wow.
That's the most memorable I can think of off the spot.
That's amazing. And that says a lot about the character of your people. And again, it goes back to the profit sharing plan and what that does in terms of Charlie Munger, you show me the incentive, I'll show you what gets done, right? And at the end of the day, when you have that incentive, that's how you operate.
Yeah.
What about creating a candidate experience that's unique and kind of memorable to your company? How did you do that? Was it about, you know, interviewing in different places? Was it just the type of questions you'd ask, the people you'd have on the panel? Like, how would you create an environment and an experience where people knew what they were walking into when they came to work at LetterLogic?
Well, they went through several interviews. So we learned the hard way to take our time in an interview and to maybe put people through 7 or 8 interviews with different people. So we did try to give them lots of love and, you know, a warm welcome when they came. We had the best receptionist in the whole world. Frank P. LaVar was his name. And you walked in that door and he received you. He popped up out of that chair and came over to warmly. He would embrace you if he had a chance to welcome you. So it started with that. But, one of the most critical things we did in the interview process, if you were going to be in customer service or in sales, where you were going to be out on the road in sales, we wanted to see how you were going to react with alcohol and how you were going to treat the wait staff, because we thought that's critical to how you are going to treat. In fact, for most hires, we took them to a meal before we hired them.
And I'm a big proponent of that. That's how I think you mix up and see people in different environments. I think it's a great idea. Go on.
Well, there was, you know, one situation where we were going to hire this woman. In fact, we were going to tell her at lunch that she had the job, and it was a great job. And she was rude and condescending to the waitress. And we all looked at each other and we knew right then, this is the last time we're spending with her. Because if she would treat the waitress like that, she would likely treat a coworker like that if she thought their position was less than hers. So that those lunch appointments and sometimes dinner appointments, so if it was sales, we took you out to dinner and, you know, we all had a cocktail or two and we wanted to see, do they know that it's time that they've had one, it's time to cut it off? Are they going to drink more? Are they going to get louder? Are they going to get more boisterous and, unruly?
Yeah. And yeah, you want to test them. You want to see what they're like in their environment. Yeah. You know, one of the things about the you know, you hear that a little bit about people who are rude to waitresses and things like that on interviews. I mean, I don't think it's ever okay, but I think the lack of self-awareness in your audience around you too is just another humongous red flag.
Like,
if you can't even put on, I'm not saying you should do this, but if you can't even put on a show of politeness for an interview of people that don't really know you, that are getting to know you, then you got no shot really. So,
exactly. I thought this is a date. You're dating and you're already showing this kind of behavior on a date.
Be your best self. Yeah. You gotta be your best self. There's enough people that sneak through. Right. Being the devil in sheep's clothing. Right. But like, if you can't even do that, then I mean, I don't even know what to say. What about if I asked you the best hire you've ever made? Does somebody come to mind?
Ooh, yeah.
You don't got to name names because people will listen to this and I want everybody thinking that you're thinking of them. But just tell me in the interview, did you know right away or was there some sort of situation where was it better than you even thought? Like, I'm just interested, like that moment where, you know, oh, this is it. And how much that, because sometimes it doesn't work out the way you want it to, right? But I'm just interested in the time it did work out, how soon you knew it and why you knew it.
A couple came to mind, but right now the most precious is as our president here, I met with her to offer her a sales job. I mean, to interview her for a sales job. And over lunch, I offered her the job the first day I met her. And she said, well, I want to come and meet the team. I want to see, you know, I want to learn more about your company first. And so she came and interviewed with them. I was out of town and they loved her as much as I did. Said she's the one. So I offered her the job again. And she said, no, I'm used to working with high performing teams and you don't have one. And so I was like, oh, I definitely got to have you now. Because she wasn't wrong.
And so what happened?
I hired her. Eventually,
what do you mean?
Like, I wore her down. I wore her down. I was like, I want to know more. Why? What made them poor performers? And so she gave really direct criticism about their lack of knowledge about the mission and vision of the company. And she said, they're not bad people, but they're just not the right people if you're going to build a fast growth company. So I brought her in sales. And then 2 years later, made her president, and then just made her co-founder because she's only 28 years old. She has, and I have to say her name because it's so important. Her name is Morgan Stanley.
I mean, you know, you're getting something world-class and you got Morgan Stanley. I mean, with JP Morgan not available. Jeez, that's amazing.
But you know, there's others. I think of, a man that I hired for the other company. I hired him, and this was really interesting. I hired him for HR, and 2 weeks in, he said, you know, you don't need a full-time HR director here, but you've got some problems in operations that I can solve. Can I tackle them? Like, have at it. And he's now a COO of a billion-dollar company. Let's see, I must have met him 15 years ago. Young guy, too. He just had that ability to see around the corners and to take initiative and just get shit done.
Make shit happen.
Yeah.
It's the old MSH there. Yeah. That's what that stands for.
I didn't know that. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. I love it. All right. Last question about hiring. What's something that frustrates you about the traditional hiring experience, either as a leader, as a manager, or as a candidate? What's something that, like, you just wish you could snap your fingers and fix.
I think that just the lack of vulnerability on both sides for people to be just honest and open. Like, I hate it when I ask somebody, so I don't ask anymore, you know, what's your, you know, worst trait? And they go, oh, I'm just a workaholic. Yeah, whatever. I want people to just be honest and be who they are.
I'll give you a tip on that, because that is something you're not going to get a great answer on that. Yeah. Usually what I ask is, what's an area that you want our help developing on once you get here, right? What's an area that you think if you had X would take you to another level or get you where you want to go in your career? Yeah. Now you reframe it as like an opportunity to learn, and they're seeing that the company's invested in you, and then you're going to find out about the areas that they struggle in without getting some, I'm a perfectionist or I'm too on time or any of those things. So
yeah,
Jared, these are some great, great answers. I'm so glad we got to talk about this. I want to take a little bit more day in the life and talk about some things outside of that. Is there anything you're working on right now that you're super excited about?
You want
to share with us?
Oh yeah.
All right, we'll do it.
You got 2 hours?
I don't got that much time, but we got enough to hear about it for sure.
Just taking, you know, Brain Trust National. So we're already in Nashville and we're in Charlotte, North Carolina with an amazing startup group there in Charlotte. And there are women all around the country and even women in other countries that want to join. And so we are getting ready to roll out a virtual model. You know, women in groups of five will meet either affinity based. So if you're all tech builders, you can be in a group of just other tech founders. Or if you want our traditional group, which is women who are totally in different industries around the table. So the ability to meet once a month, since it's virtual, it's just 2 hours, but with highly curated groups. And then I'm probably for the first time ever going to raise some money to blow this thing up, because the opportunity is too great to impact so many more women. So I don't know if you know this, and this is a little aside, but UBS and other organizations like that have noticed that women are coming into a ton of wealth. Like, women are between now and 2030 are inheriting $9 trillion. Yeah. So where we've been kept out of a lot of areas, we are going to have an impact.
I have to imagine that's happening for minorities and all types of different traditionally disenfranchised groups.
Yes.
Where there's more wealth, there's more money creation. So as much as there's so much further to go, and that's what companies like Brain Trust are helping with, we should also acknowledge there's been good progress and there will continue to be good progress, but we have to stay vigilant and keep pushing on that. But that's amazing. So that does make a ton of sense that would be a lot of wealth, you know, that's transitioning from people have been doing this for many, many years into their daughter's hands. I have three daughters myself, and my son is my baby boy. So, wow, that's a really incredible statistic. What about, is there like a book you read recently that you would share with our listeners, or maybe some content you're watching that you really want to share?
I'm reading right now Thinking Bigger. Sarah Dusek is the author. She is the woman who founded Under the Canvas, which was like a global glamping company, which she just sold for a boatload of money. And it's a book about how to write your pitch deck. And I think it is just so accessible to everybody. And like, these are the things that must be in your pitch deck, and this is how to do it. But I think it's the best book I've read on that. And then my all-time favorite books is Essentialism.
Essentialism?
Yes.
Who wrote that? Do you know?
You
don't have to. We can put it in the show notes. What's it about, though?
It is about doing less and doing what's most important. Having less and having just what's important, and really focusing on what's the most important thing and what's essential, and focusing all your time and energy on that instead of a lot of the fluff and the things that weigh us down.
Hmm. All right, last question, then I got speed round for you. What's some advice that you had to give 20-year-old Sherry that you didn't know then but that you know now?
To surround myself to find a tribe, to find myself with people who are smarter than me, and to spend as much time with them as possible and to soak up as much of their knowledge as possible, because I was so insecure about my lack of knowledge. I was very lacking in confidence. And if I'd had the confidence then, I could rule the world.
I love that. The whole concept of what you do, I was thinking about this when you first started telling us about brain trust, is around tribalism, is around community. It's around being together and learning from each other and helping each other and serving each other, which I know, unfortunately, every year seems to get, you know, more isolated and less of a thing.
Yeah.
I was telling somebody the other day that I was somebody that's deep in the world of AI and technology and believes that there is going to be, you know, different things that are happening, many positive, but also some not so great things. The small things is going to really start to stand out. The things that you do for others, the way that you serve, those innately human things are actually going to be some of the uniquest and best differentiators as we move into, you know, a world where obviously technology is going to be even more intrinsic and more pervasive in everything we do. So I think that is incredible advice from your part. All right, I want to do some speed round with you, okay? I didn't prepare you for this, so we're gonna shoot off the hip here. Here we go. It's Nashville theme, okay?
All right.
Best restaurant in Nashville?
Cafe Nona.
Cafe Nona. What do they serve there?
It's a little pasta place.
Pasta place? Mm-hmm. Why do you love it so much?
It's, you know, authentically Italian. It's small. It's very intimate, and it's a long wait to get in, but it's just fantastic, and it's comfort food.
I really just asked that for my own edifice because I'm going there in Nashville pretty soon, so I want to go to Cafe Nona.
Okay.
What is the quintessential Nashville dish?
Hot chicken.
Who does it best?
Prince's, the original. Prince's.
Yes, I agree. Love Prince's. You know what? My other thing that I didn't really know about Nashville is craft cocktail scene is the best I've ever seen.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
It is. And it's like, I live here in South Florida and you like to think that this would be a great craft cocktail scene. I've never been somewhere like in Nashville where you go to a hole in the wall. I think there's a place called Mother Hubbard's that I went to last time I was there. Anywhere you go to the Bourbon Steak, you go and you're going to get craft cocktails that are incredible. What is your top go-to craft cocktail?
Well, my top, it's not in Nashville, it's in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, and it is a mezcal margarita. But
mezcal, I love mezcal. I love the smokiness. I love getting a good mezcal drink. Is that your favorite, like tequila mezcal? Is that what would you say that's probably the favorite? Yeah, me too. We're going to get it. We're going to grab a drink together when we get out there. What's the best concert you've seen in Nashville?
Eric Church. At the arena at Bridgestone. It was amazing.
Bridgestone?
Eric Church. I mean, my husband doesn't even like country music, and I've kind of forced him to start listening to Eric Church. And we went, and we stood the entire 2 hours, and like, it was fantastic. Yeah. But the best place for music in Nashville, bar none, is the Bluebird Cafe.
Okay. And why is that?
It is the best listening room in the world. In the world. It only holds 100 people. It is songwriters, Grammy Award-winning songwriters who sing their songs and tell you why they wrote it, who inspired it, how much money they made on it, who recorded it. It's raucous. It's fun. It's inspiring. It is really hard to get in, and it is amazing. It's not expensive. It's just so many people want to get in that it's really hard.
Ooh, I like that. That's a good recommendation. All right, last one. You've been in Nashville for a while. It's obviously had tremendous growth since you first moved there, right, from North Carolina. What's the most exciting and best thing about that? And what's the thing that you could do with all that growth and change?
The best thing about it is just the entrepreneurial community. Oh my gosh, you don't realize this, but Nashville, Tennessee has the third largest chapter of EO in the world. We're the largest in the US. So the entrepreneurial community is amazing. And the worst part of it is traffic. I never thought we'd have a traffic problem in Nashville, but it's out of control.
Well, Sherry, I got to tell you, I know you know this. You're an incredible podcast guest. You had so many stories. I think you're very inspiring. A lot of people are going to listen to this and get a lot of great ideas for their companies and the way that they manage and the way that they lead. You're an inspiration to us all. I really appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Tell everybody to buy my book, Lunch with Lucy, because it's filled with tips that really work to build your team and to make your company as profitable as possible.
Yeah, I mean, how impolite of me. So Lunch with Lucy, that's your book. Where else can people find out information about you and your companies?
Ourbraintrust.org.
Okay. I love it. Thank you so much for coming on, Sherry.
Thank you for having me. Loved every minute of it.